Side 5, Rising Sun by Michael Crichton.
Continuing on page 176.
It's over, I said. I'm just trying to get the tapes copied.
Make sure that's all it is, he said.
Right, Jim.
For the good of the whole department and the individuals in it, I want this thing behind us.
Right, Jim. I don't want to lose control of this situation.
I understand. I hope you do, he said. Get the copies made and get your ass down here. And he hung up. I parked the car and went into the physics building. I waited at the top of the lecture hall while Philip Sanders finished his lecture. He stood in front of a blackboard covered with complex formulas. There were about 30 students in the room, most of them seated down near the front. I could see the backs of their heads. Dr. Sanders was about 40 years old, one of those energetic types, in constant motion, pacing back and forth, tapping the equations on the blackboard in short, emphatic jabs with his chalk as he pointed to the signal covariant ratio determination and the factorial delta bandwidth noise. I couldn't even guess what subject he was teaching. Finally, I concluded it must be electrical engineering. When the bell rang on the hour, the class stood and packed up their bags. I was startled. Nearly everyone in the class was Asian, both men and women. Those that weren't Oriental were Indian or Pakistani. Out of 30 students, only 3 were white. That's right, Sanders said to me later, as we walked down the hallway toward his laboratory. A class like Physics 101 doesn't attract Americans. It's been that way for years. Industry can't find them either. We would be up shit creek if we didn't have the Orientals and Indians who come here to get doctorates in math and engineering and then work for American companies. We continued down some stairs and turned left. We were in a basement passageway. Sanders walked quickly. But the trouble is, it's changing, he continued. My Asian students are starting to go home. Koreans are going back to Korea. Taiwanese, the same. Even Indians are returning home. The standard of living is going up in their countries, and there's more opportunity back home now. Some of these foreign countries have large numbers of well-trained people. He led me briskly down a flight of stairs. Do you know what city has the highest number of PhDs per capita in the world? Boston. Seoul, Korea. Think about that as we rocket into the 21st century. Now we were going down another corridor, then briefly outside, into sunlight, down a covered walkway, and back into another building. Sanders kept glancing back over his shoulder as if he was afraid of losing me. But he never stopped talking. And with foreign students going home, we don't have enough engineers to do American research, to create new American technology. It's a simple balance sheet, not enough trained people. Even big companies like IBM are starting to have trouble. Trained people simply don't exist. Watch the door. The door swung back toward me. I went through. I said, but if there are all these high-tech job opportunities, won't they begin to attract students? Not like investment banking or law. Sanders laughed. America may lack engineers and scientists, but we lead the world in the production of lawyers. America has half the lawyers in the entire world. Think of that. He shook his head. We have 4% of the world population. We have 18% of the world economy. But we have 50% of the lawyers. And 35,000 more every year pouring out of the schools. That's where our productivity is directed. That's where our national focus is. Half our TV shows are about lawyers. America has become land of lawyers. Everybody suing, everybody disputing, everybody in court. After all, 750,000 American lawyers have to do something. They have to make their $300,000 a year. Other countries think we're crazy. He unlocked a door. I saw a sign that said, Advanced Imaging Laboratory in hand-painted lettering and an arrow. Sanders led me down a long basement hallway. Even our brightest kids are badly educated. The best American kids now rank 12th in the world, after the industrialized countries of Asia and Europe. And that's our top students. At the bottom, it's worse. 1/3 of high school graduates can't read a bus schedule. They're illiterate. We came to the end of the hallway and turned right.
and the kids I see are lazy. Nobody wants to work. I teach physics. It takes years to master. But all the kids want to dress like Charlie Sheen and make $1 million before they're 28. The only way you can make that kind of money is in law, investment banking, Wall Street. Places where the game is paper profits, something for nothing. But that's what the kids want to do these days.
Maybe at USC.
Trust me, everywhere. They all watch television.
He swung another door open. Still another corridor. This one smelled moldy, damp.
I know. I'm old-fashioned, Sanders said. I still believe that every human being stands for something. You stand for something. I stand for something. Just being on this planet, wearing the clothes we wear, doing the work we do, we each stand for something. And in this little corner of the world, he said, we stand for cutting the crap. We analyze network news and see where they have been fucking around with the tape. We analyze TV commercials and show where the tricks are.
Sanders suddenly stopped. What's the matter?
Wasn't there someone else? He said. Didn't you come here with someone else?
No, just me.
Oh, good.
Sanders continued on at his same breakneck pace. I always worry about losing people down here.
Ah, okay. Here we are. The lab.
Good. This door is just where I left it. With a flourish, he threw the door open. I stared at the room, shocked.
I know it doesn't look like much, Sanders said.
That, I thought, was a serious understatement. I was looking at a basement space with rusty pipes and fittings hanging down from the ceiling. The green linoleum on the floor curled up in several places to expose concrete beneath. Arranged around the room were battered wooden tables, each heaped with equipment and drooping wires down the side. At each table, a student sat facing monitors. In several places, water plinked into buckets on the floor. Sanders said, "The only space we could get was here in the basement, and we don't have the money to put in little amenities like a ceiling. Never mind, doesn't matter. Just watch your head." He moved forward into the room. I am about 180 centimeters tall, not quite 6 feet, and I had to crouch to enter the room. From somewhere in the ceiling above, I heard a harsh, rasping sizzle.
"Skaters," Sanders explained.
"Sorry?"
"We're underneath the ice rink. You get used to it. Actually, it's not bad now. When they have hockey practice in the afternoon, then it's a bit noisy."
We moved deeper into the room. I felt like I was in a submarine. I glanced at the students at their workstations. They were all intent on their work. Nobody looked up as we passed. Sanders said,
"What kind of tape do you want to duplicate?"
8mm Japanese. Security tape. It might be difficult."
"Difficult? I doubt that very much," Sanders said. "You know, back in my youth, I wrote most of the early video image enhancement algorithms. You know, despeckling and inversion and edge tracing, that stuff. The Sanders algorithms were the ones everybody used. I was a graduate student at Caltech then. I worked at JPL in my spare time."
No, we can do it." I handed him the tape. He looked at it.
"Cute little bugger."
I said, "What happened to all your algorithms?"
"There was no commercial use for them," he said. "Back in the 80s, American companies like RCA and GE got out of commercial electronics entirely. My image enhancement programs didn't have much use in America."
He shrugged.
"So I tried to sell them to Sony in Japan."
"And?"
"The Japanese had already patented the products in Japan."
"You mean they already had the algorithms?"
"No, they just had patents. In Japan, patenting is a form of war. The Japanese patent like crazy. And they have a strange system. It takes 8 years to get a patent in Japan, but your application is made public after 18 months, after which royalties are moot. And, of course, Japan doesn't have reciprocal licensing agreements with America. It's one of the ways they keep their edge. Anyway, when I got to Japan, I found Sony and Hitachi had some related patents, and they had done what is called patent flooding, meaning they covered possible related uses. They didn't have the rights to use my algorithms, but I discovered I didn't have the rights either, because they had already patented the use of my invention." He shrugged. "It's complicated to explain. Anyway, that's ancient history.
By now, the Japanese have devised much more complicated video software, far surpassing anything we have. They're years ahead of us now. But we struggle along in this lab. Ah, just the person we need. Dan, are you busy? A young woman looked up from the computer console. Large eyes, horn-rimmed glasses, dark hair. Her face was partially blocked by the ceiling pipes. You're not Dan, Sanders said, sounding surprised. Where's Dan, Teresa?
Picking up a midterm, Teresa said. I'm just helping run the real-time progressions. They're finishing now.
I had the impression that she was older than the other students. It was hard to say why, exactly. It certainly wasn't her clothes. She wore a bright-colored headband and a U2 t-shirt under a jeans jacket. But she had a calm quality that made her seem older. Can you switch to something else? Sanders said, walking around the table to look at the monitor. Because we have a rush job here. We have to help out the police. I followed Sanders, ducking pipes.
Sure, I guess, the woman said.
She started to shut down units on the desk. Her back was turned to me, and then finally I could see her. She was dark, exotic-looking, almost Eurasian. In fact, she was beautiful, drop-dead beautiful. She looked like one of those high-cheek-boned models in magazines. And for a moment I was confused, because this woman was too beautiful to be working in some basement electronics laboratory. It didn't make sense. Say hello to Teresa Asakuma, he said, the only Japanese graduate student working here. Hi, I said. I blushed. I felt stupid. I felt that information was coming at me too fast. And all things considered, I would rather not have a Japanese handling these tapes. But her first name wasn't Japanese, and she didn't look Japanese. She looked Eurasian, or perhaps part Japanese. So exotic. Maybe she was even...
Good morning, Lieutenant, she said.
She extended her left hand, the wrong hand, for me to shake. She held it out to me sideways, the way someone does when their right hand is injured. I shook hands with her.
Hello, Miss Asakuma. Teresa.
Okay. Isn't she beautiful? Sanders said, acting as if he took credit for it. Just beautiful.
Yes, I said. Actually, I'm surprised you're not a model.
There was an awkward moment. I couldn't tell why. She turned quickly away.
It never interested me, she said.
And Sanders immediately jumped in and said, Teresa, Lieutenant Smith needs us to copy some tapes. These tapes. Sanders held one out to her. She took it in her left hand and held it to the light. Her right hand remained bent at the elbow, pressed to her waist. Then I saw that her right arm was withered, ending in a fleshy stump protruding beyond the sleeve of her jeans jacket. It looked like the arm of a thalidomide baby.
Quite interesting, she said, squinting at the tape. 8 millimeter high density. Maybe it's the proprietary digital format we've been hearing about, the one that includes real-time image enhancement.
I'm sorry, I don't know, I said. I was feeling foolish for having said anything about being a model. I dug into my box and brought out the playback machine. Teresa immediately took a screwdriver and removed the top. She bent over the innards. I saw a green circuit board, a black motor, and 3 small crystal cylinders.
Yes, it's the new setup. Very slick. Dr. Sanders, look. They're doing it with just 3 heads. The board must generate component RGB, because over here... You think this is compression circuitry?
Probably digital to analog converter, Sanders said. Very neat. So small. He turned to me, holding up the box. You know how the Japanese can make things this way and we can't? They kaizen 'em. A process of deliberate, patient, continual refinements. Each year the products get a little better, a little smaller, a little cheaper. Americans don't think that way. Americans are always looking for the quantum leap, the big advance forward. Americans try to hit a home run to knock it out of the park, and then sit back. The Japanese just hit singles all day long, and they never sit back. So with something like this, you're looking at an expression of philosophy as much as anything. He talked like this for a while, pivoting the cylinders, admiring it. Finally, I said, Can you copy the tapes?
Sure, Teresa said. From the converter, We can run a signal out of this machine and lay it down on whatever media you like. You want three-quarter, optical master, VHS?
VHS,
I said. That's easy, she said. But will it be an accurate copy? The people at JPL said they couldn't guarantee the copy would be accurate.
Oh, hell, JPL, Sanders said. They just talk like that because they work for the government. We get things done here. Right, Teresa? But Teresa wasn't listening. I watched her plugging cables and wires, moving swiftly with her good hand, using her stump to stabilize and hold the box. Like many disabled people, her movements were so fluid it was hardly noticeable that her right hand was missing. Soon she had the small playback machine hooked to a second recorder and several different monitors. What are all these?
To check the signal.
You mean for playback?
No. The big monitor there will show the image. The others let me look at the signal characteristics and the data map. How the image has been laid down on the tape.
I said, you need to do that?
No, I just want to snoop. I'm curious about how they've set up this high-density format.
Sanders said to me, what is the actual source material?
It's from an office security camera.
And this tape is original?
I think so. Why?
Well, if it's original material, we want to be extra careful with it, Sanders said. He was talking to Teresa, instructing her. We don't want to set up any feedback loops scrambling the media surface, or signal leaks off the heads that will compromise the integrity of the data stream.
Don't worry, she said. I got it handled.
She pointed to her setup.
See that? It'll warn of an impedance shift, and I'm monitoring the central processor, too.
Okay, Sanders said. He was beaming like a proud parent.
How long will this take? I said. Not long. We can lay down the signal at very high speed. The rate limit is a function of the playback device, and it seems to have a fast-forward scan. So maybe 2 or 3 minutes per tape.
I glanced at my watch. I have a 10:30 appointment I can't be late for, and I don't want to leave these.
You need all of them done?
Actually, just 5 are critical.
Then let's do those first.
We ran the first few seconds of each tape, one after another, looking for the 5 that came from the cameras on the 46th floor. As each tape started, I saw the camera image on the central monitor of Teresa's table. On the side monitors, signal traces bounced and jiggled like an intensive care unit. I mentioned it.
That's just about right, she said. Intensive care for video.
She ejected one tape, stuck in another, and started it up.
Whoops. Did you say this material was original?
It's not. These tapes are copies.
How do you know?
Because we got a wind-up signature.
Teresa bent over the equipment, staring at the signal traces, making fine adjustments with her knobs and dials.
I think that's what you got, yes, Sanders said.
He turned to me.
You see, with video, it's difficult to detect a copy in the image itself. The older analog video shows some degradation in successive generations, but in a digital system like this, there is no difference at all. Each copy is literally identical to the master.
Then how can you say the tapes are copies?
Teresa isn't looking at the picture, Sanders said. She's looking at the signal. Even though we can't detect a copy from the image, sometimes we can determine the image came from another video playback instead of a camera.
I shook my head.
How?
Teresa said, it has to do with how the signal is laid down in the first half second of taping. If the recording video is started before the playback video, there is sometimes a slight fluctuation in the signal output as the playback machine starts up. It's a mechanical function. The playback motors can't get up to speed instantaneously. There are electronic circuits in the playback machine to minimize the effect, but there's always an interval of getting up to speed.
And that's what you detected?
She nodded. It's called a wind-up signature.
Sanders said, and that never happens if the signal is coming direct from a camera, because a camera has no moving parts. A camera is instantaneously up to speed at all times.
I frowned.
So these tapes are copies.
Is that bad? Sanders said.
I don't know. If they were copied, they might also be changed, right?
In theory, yes, Sanders said. In practice, we'd have to look carefully. And it would be very hard to know for certain. These tapes come from a Japanese company?
Yes.
Nakamoto? I nodded. Yes. Frankly, I'm not surprised they gave you copies, Sanders said. The Japanese are extremely cautious. They're not very trusting of outsiders. And Japanese corporations in America feel the way we would feel doing business in Nigeria. They think they're surrounded by savages.
Hey, Teresa said.
Sorry, Sanders said, but you know what I mean. The Japanese feel they have to put up with us, with our ineptitude, our slowness, our stupidity, our incompetence. That makes them self-protective. So if these tapes have any legal significance, the last thing they'd do is turn the originals over to a barbarian policeman like you.
No.
They'd give you a copy and keep the original in case they need it for their defense. Fully confident that with your inferior American video technology, you'd never be able to detect that it was a copy anyway.
I frowned. How long would it take to make copies?
Not long, Sanders said, shaking his head. The way Teresa is scanning now, 5 minutes a tape. I imagine the Japanese can do it much faster, say 2 minutes a tape.
In that case, they had plenty of time to make copies last night.
As we talked, Teresa was continuing to shuffle the tapes, looking at the first portions of each. As each image came up, she glanced at me. I would shake my head. I was seeing all the different security cameras. Finally, the first of the tapes from the 46th floor appeared, the familiar office image I had seen before.
That's one.
Okay, here we go, laying it onto VHS. Teresa started the first copy. She ran the tape forward at high speed, the images streaky and quick. On the side monitors, the signals bounced and jittered nervously. She said,
"Does this have something to do with the murder last night?"
Yes, you know about that?
She shrugged. I saw it on the news. The killer died in a car crash?
That's right, I said. She was turned away. The three-quarter profile of her face was strikingly beautiful, the high curve of her cheekbone. I thought of what a playboy Eddie Sakamura was known to be. I said, did you know him?
No,
she said. After a moment she added,
he was Japanese.
Another moment of awkwardness descended on our little group. There was something that both Teresa and Sanders seemed to know that I did not. But I didn't know how to ask, so I watched the video. Once again, I saw the sunlight moving across the floor. Then the room lights came up as the office personnel thinned. Now the floor was empty. And then at high speed, Cheryl Austin appeared, followed by the man. They kissed passionately. Aha, Sanders said. Is this it?
Yes.
He frowned as he watched the action progress.
You mean the murder is recorded?
Yes, I said, on multiple cameras.
You're kidding.
Sanders fell silent, watching events proceed. With the streaky high-speed image, it was difficult to see more than the basic events. The two people moving to the conference room. The sudden struggle, forcing her back on the table. Stepping away suddenly, leaving the room in haste. Nobody spoke. We all watched the tape. I glanced at Teresa. Her face was blank. The image was reflected in her glasses. Eddie passed the mirror and went into the dark passageway. The tape ran on for a few more seconds, and then the cassette popped out.
That's one. You say there are multiple cameras? How many altogether?
Five, I think, I said. She marked the first cassette with a stick-on label. She started the second tape in the machine and began another high-speed duplication. I said,
these copies are exact?
Oh, yes.
So they're legal?
Sanders frowned. Legal in what sense?
Well, as evidence in a court of law.
Oh, no, Sanders said. These tapes would never be admissible in a court of law.
But if they're exact copies...
It's nothing to do with that. All forms of photographic evidence, including video, are no longer admissible in court.
I haven't heard that, I said. It hasn't happened yet, Sanders said. The case law isn't entirely clear, but it's coming. All photographs are suspect these days, because now, with digital systems, they can be changed perfectly. Perfectly. And that's something new. Remember years ago how the Russians would remove politicians from photographs of their May Day lineups? It was always a crude cut-and-paste job, and you could always see that something had been done. There was a funny space between the shoulders of the remaining people, or a discoloration on the back wall. Or you could see the brush strokes of the retoucher who tried to smooth over the damage. But anyway, you could see it fairly easily. You could see the picture had been altered. The whole business was laughable.
I remember, I said.
Photographs always had integrity precisely because they were impossible to change. So we considered photographs to represent reality. But for several years now, computers have allowed us to make seamless alterations of photographic images. A few years back, the National Geographic moved the Great Pyramid of Egypt on a cover photo. The editors didn't like where the pyramid was, and they thought it would compose better if it was moved. So they just altered the photograph and moved it. Nobody could tell. But if you go back to Egypt with a camera and try to duplicate that picture, you'll find you can't. Because there is no place in the real world where the pyramids line up that way. The photograph no longer represents reality. But you can't tell. Minor example.
And someone could do the same thing to this tape?
In theory, any video can be changed. On the monitor, I watched the murder occurring a second time. This camera was from the far end of the room. It didn't show the actual murder very well, but afterward, Sakamura was clearly visible as he walked toward the camera. I said, "The image could be changed how?" Sanders laughed. "These days, you can make any damn change you want."
"Could you change the identity of the murderer?"
"Technically, yes," Sanders said. "Mapping a face onto a complex moving object is now possible. Technically possible. But as a practical matter, it'd be a bitch to do." I said nothing. But it was just as well. Sakamura was our leading suspect, and he was dead. The chief wanted the case finished. So did I. "Of course," Sanders said, "the Japanese have all sorts of fancy video algorithms for surface mapping and three-dimensional transformations. They can do things we can't begin to imagine." He drummed his fingers on the table again. "What is the timetable of these tapes? What's their history?" I said, "The murder happened at 8:30 last night, as shown on the clock. We were told the tapes were removed from the security office around 8:45 p.m. We asked for them, and there was some back and forth with the Japanese. As always. And when did you finally take possession?"
"They were delivered to division headquarters around 1:30 a.m.
"Okay," Sanders said. "That means they had the tapes from 8:45 to 1:30.
"Right. A little less than 5 hours."
Sanders frowned. "Five tapes with five different camera angles to change in 5 hours?" Sanders shook his head. "No way. It just can't be done, Lieutenant."
"Yeah," Teresa said. "It's impossible, even for them. It's just too many pixels to change."
I said, "You're sure about that?"
"Well," Teresa said, "the only way it could be done that fast is with an automated program, and even the most sophisticated programs need you to polish the details by hand. Things like bad blur can give it all away."
"Bad blur?" I said. I found I liked asking her questions. I liked looking at her face. "Bad motion blur," Sanders said. "Video runs at 30 frames a second. You can think of each frame of video as a picture that's shot at a shutter speed of 1/30th of a second, which is very slow, much slower than pocket cameras. If you film a runner at 1/30th of a second, the legs are just streaks, blurs. That's called motion blur. And if you alter it by a mechanical process, it starts to look wrong. The image appears too sharp, too crisp. Edges look odd. It's back to the Russians. You can see it's been changed. For realistic motion, you need the right amount of blur.
I see.
Teresa said,
And there's the color shift.
Right, Sanders said. Inside the blur itself, there is a color shift. For example, look there on the monitor. The man is wearing a blue suit, and his coat is swinging out as he spins the girl around the room. Now, if you take a frame of that action and blow it up to its pixels, you will find that the coat is navy, but the blur is progressive shades of lighter blue until at the edge it seems almost transparent. You can't tell from a single frame exactly where the coat ends and the background begins.
I could vaguely imagine it.
Okay. If the edge colors don't blend smoothly, you will notice it immediately. It can take hours to clean up a few seconds of tape, as in a commercial. But if you don't do it, you will see it like that. He snapped his fingers.
So even though they duplicated the tapes, they couldn't have altered them?
Not in 5 hours, Sanders said. They just didn't have time.
Then we are seeing what actually happened.
No doubt about it, Sanders said. But we'll poke around with this image anyway, after you go. Teresa wants to fiddle with it. I know she does. So do I. Check in with us later today. We'll tell you if there's anything funny. But basically, it can't be done. And it wasn't done here.
As I pulled into the parking circle at the Sunset Hills Country Club, I saw Connor standing in front of the big stucco clubhouse. He bowed to the 3 Japanese golfers standing with him, and they bowed back. Then he shook hands with them all, tossed the clubs into the back seat, and got into my car.
You're late, Kohai.
Sorry, it's only a few minutes. I was held up at USC.
Your lateness inconvenienced everyone. As a matter of politeness, they felt obliged to keep me company in front of the club while I waited for you. Men of their position are not comfortable standing around. They are busy. But they felt obligated and could not leave me there. You embarrassed me very much, and you reflected poorly on the department.
I'm sorry, I didn't realize.
Start to realize, Kohai. You're not alone in the world.
I put the car in gear and drove out. I looked at the Japanese in the rearview mirror. They were waving as we left. They did not appear unhappy or in a rush to leave.
Who are you playing with?
Aoki-san is the head of Tokyo Marine in Vancouver. Hanada-san is a vice president of Mitsui Bank in London. And Kenichi Asaka runs all of Toyota's Southeast Asian plants from KL to Singapore. He's based in Bangkok.
What are they doing here?
They're on vacation, Connor said. A short holiday in the States for golf. They find it pleasant to relax in a slower-paced country like ours.
I drove up the winding drive to Sunset Boulevard and stopped to wait for the light.
Where to?
The Four Seasons Hotel.
I turned right, heading toward Beverly Hills.
And why are these men playing golf with you?
Oh, we go way back, he said. A few favors here and there over the years. I'm nobody important, but relationships must be maintained. A phone call, a small gift, a game when you're in town. Because you never know when you will need your network. Relationships are your source of information, your safety valve, and your early warning system. In the Japanese way of seeing the world.
Who asked for this game?
Hanada-san was already intending to play. I just joined him. I'm quite a good golfer, you know.
Why did you want to play?
Because I wanted to know more about the Saturday meetings, Connor said.
I remembered the Saturday meetings. On the video we had seen at the newsroom, Sakamura had grabbed Cheryl Austin and said,
You don't understand. This is all about the Saturday meetings.
And did they tell you?
Connor nodded.
Apparently they began a long time ago, he said. 1980 or so. First they were held in the Century Plaza, and later in the Sheraton, and finally in the Biltmore.
Connor stared out the window. The car jounced over the potholes on Sunset Boulevard. For several years, the meetings were a regular event. Prominent Japanese industrialists who happened to be in town would attend an ongoing discussion of what should be done about America, of how the American economy should be managed.
What?
Yes. That's outrageous. Why?
Connor said.
Why? Because this is our country. You can't have a bunch of foreigners sitting around in secret meetings and deciding how to manage it.
The Japanese don't see it that way, Connor said.
I'm sure they don't. I'm sure they think they have a goddamn right.
Connor shrugged. As a matter of fact, that's exactly what they think. And the Japanese believe they have earned the right to decide.
Christ!
Because they have invested heavily in our economy. They have lent us a lot of money, Peter. A lot of money. Hundreds of billions of dollars. For most of the last 15 years, the United States has run $1 billion of trade deficit a week with Japan. That's $1 billion every week that they must do something with. A torrent of money roaring toward them. They don't especially want so many dollars. What can they do with all their excess billions? They decided to lend the money back to us. Our government was running a budget deficit year after year. We weren't paying for our own programs. So the Japanese financed our budget deficit. They invested in us, and they lent their money, based on certain assurances from our government. Washington assured the Japanese that we would set our house in order. We would cut our deficit. We would improve education, rebuild our infrastructure, even raise taxes if necessary. In short, we would clean up our act. Because only then does an investment in America make sense.
Uh-huh, I said.
But we did none of those things. We let the deficit get worse, and we devalued the dollar. We cut its value in half in 1985. You know what that did to Japanese investments in America? It fucked them. Whatever they invested in 1984 now paid half its previous return. I vaguely remembered something about this. I said, I thought we did that to help our trade deficit, to boost exports. We did, but it didn't work. Our trade balance with Japan got worse. Normally, if you do your currency by half, the cost of everything imported doubles. But the Japanese slashed prices on their VCRs and copiers and held their market share. Remember, business is war. All we really accomplished was to make American land and American companies cheap for the Japanese to buy, because the yen was now twice as strong as it had been. We made the biggest banks in the world all Japanese. And we made America a poor country.
What does this have to do with the Saturday meetings?
Well, Connor said, suppose you have an uncle who is a drunk. He says if you lend him money, he'll stop drinking. But he doesn't stop drinking, and you'd like to get your money. You want to salvage what you can from your bad investment. Also, you know that your uncle, being a drunk, is likely to get loaded and hurt somebody. Your uncle is out of control, so something has to be done. And the family sits down together to decide what to do about their problem uncle. That's what the Japanese decided to do.
Uh-huh.
Connor must have heard the skepticism in my voice. Look, he said, get this conspiracy stuff out of your head. Do you want to take over Japan? Do you want to run their country? Of course not. No sensible country wants to take over another country. Do business, yes. Have a relationship, yes. But not take over. Nobody wants the responsibility. Nobody wants to be bothered. Just like with the drunken uncle. You only have those meetings when you're forced to. It's a last resort.
So that's how the Japanese see it?
They see billions and billions of their dollars, Kohai, invested in a country that's in deep trouble, that's filled with strange, individualistic people who talk constantly, who confront each other constantly, who argue all the time, people who aren't well-educated, who don't know much about the world, who get their information from television, people who don't work very hard, who tolerate violence and drug use, and who don't seem to object to it. The Japanese have billions of dollars in this peculiar land, and they would like a decent return on their investment. And even though the American economy is collapsing, it will soon be third in the world after Japan and Europe, it's still important to try and hold it together, which is all they're trying to do.
That's it, I said. They're just doing the good work of saving America?
Somebody needs to do it, Connors said. We can't go on this way.
We'll manage.
That's what the English always said.
He shook his head.
But now England is poor, and America is becoming poor, too.
Why is it becoming poor? I said, speaking louder than I intended.
The Japanese say it's because America has become a land without substance. We let our manufacturing go. We don't make things anymore. When you manufacture products, you add value to raw materials, and you literally create wealth. But America has stopped doing that. Americans make money now by paper manipulation, which the Japanese say is bound to catch up to us because paper profits don't reflect real wealth. They think our fascination with Wall Street and junk bonds is crazy.
And therefore the Japanese ought to manage us?
They think someone ought to manage us. They'd prefer we do it ourselves.
Jesus.
Connor shifted in his seat. Save your outrage, Kohai, because according to Hanada-san, the Saturday meeting stopped in 1991.
Oh?
Yes. That was when the Japanese decided not to worry about whether America would clean up its act. They saw advantages in the present situation. America is asleep and inexpensive to buy.
So there aren't Saturday meetings anymore?
There are occasional ones, because of Nichibei, the ongoing Japanese-American relationship. The economies of the two countries are interlocked by now. Neither country can pull out, even if they wanted to. But the meetings are no longer important. They are basically social functions. So what Sakamura said to Cheryl Austin is wrong, and her death had nothing to do with the Saturday meetings.
What does it have to do with?
My friends seem to think it was personal. An injozata, a crime of passion, involving a beautiful Kichigai woman and a jealous man.
And you believe them?
Well, the thing is, they were unanimous. All three of these businessmen. Of course, Japanese are reluctant to express disagreement among themselves, even on the golf course of an underdeveloped peasant country. But I have learned that unanimity toward a gaijin may cover a multitude of sins.
You think they were lying?
Not exactly. Connor shook his head. But I had the impression they were telling me something by not telling me. This morning was a game of Hara no Naka o Misenai. My friends were not forthcoming.
Connor described his golf game. There had been long silences all morning. Everyone in the foursome was polite and considerate, but spoken comments were rare and reserved. Most of the time, the men walked over the course in complete silence.
And you had gone there for information? I said. How could you stand it?
Oh, I was getting information. But as he explained it, it was all unspoken. Basically, the Japanese have an understanding based on centuries of shared culture, and they are able to communicate feelings without words. It's the closeness that exists in America between a parent and child. A child often understands everything just from a parent's glance. But Americans don't rely on unspoken communication as a general rule, and the Japanese do. It is as if all Japanese are members of the same family, and they can communicate without words. To a Japanese, silences have meaning.
It's nothing mystical or wonderful, Connor said. For the most part, it is because the Japanese are so hemmed in by rules and conventions, they end up unable to say anything at all. For politeness, to save face, the other person is obliged to read the situation, the context, and the subtle signs of body posture and unstated feeling. Because the first person feels he can't actually put anything into words. Any speaking at all would be indelicate. So the point must be gotten across in other ways.
I said, and that's how your morning was spent? Not talking?
Connor shook his head. He felt he had quite clear communication with the Japanese golfers and wasn't troubled by the silences at all.
Because I was asking them to talk about other Japanese, members of their family,
I had to frame my questions with great delicacy. Just as I would if I were asking whether your sister was in jail, or any subject that was painful or awkward for you. I would be attentive to how long it took you to answer, and the pauses between your statements, the tone of your voice, all sorts of things, beyond the literal communication. Okay?
Okay.
It means you get the feeling by an intuition.
And what was the intuition you got?
They said, "We are mindful that you have performed services for us in the past. We feel a desire to help you now. But this murder is a Japanese matter, and thus we are unable to tell you everything that we might like to. From our reticence, you may draw useful conclusions about the underlying issue." That's what they said to me.
And what is the underlying issue?
Well, Connor said, they mentioned Microcon several times.
That high-tech company?
Yes, the one that's being sold. Apparently, it's a small company in Silicon Valley that makes specialized computer machinery. And there are political problems about the sale. They referred to those problems several times.
So this murder has something to do with Microcon?
I think so. He shifted in his chair. By the way, what did you learn at USC about the tapes?
For one thing, that they were duplicated.
Connor nodded. I assumed that, he said.
You did?
Ishiguro would never give us the originals. The Japanese think everybody who is not Japanese is a barbarian. They mean it, literally. Barbarian. Stinking, vulgar, stupid barbarian. They're polite about it because they know you can't help the misfortune of not being born Japanese. But they still think it.
I nodded. That was more or less what Sanders had said, too.
The other thing, Connor said, is that the Japanese are extremely successful, but they are not daring. They are plotters and plotters. So they're not going to give us the originals because they don't want to take any chances. Now, what else did you learn about the tapes?
What makes you think there was something else? I said.
When you looked at the tapes, he said, I'm sure you noticed an important detail that...
And then we were interrupted by the telephone.
Captain Connor, said a cheerful voice over the speakerphone. This is Jerry Orr, over at Sunset Hills Country Club. You left without taking the papers with you.
The papers?
The application, Orr said. You need to fill it out, Captain. Of course it's just routine. I can assure you there won't be any problem with it, considering who your sponsors are.
My sponsors, Connor said.
Yes, sir, Orr said. And congratulations. As you know, it's almost impossible to obtain a membership at Sunset these days. But Mr. Haneda's company had already bought a corporate membership some time ago, and they have decided to put it in your name. I must say, it's a very nice gesture from your friends.
Yes, it is, Connor said, frowning. I was looking at him.
They know how fond you are of playing golf here, Orr said. You know the terms, of course. Haneda will purchase the membership over 5 years, but after that time, it'll be transferred to your name. So when you retire from club membership, you're free to sell it. Now, will you be picking up the paperwork here, or should I send it to your home?
Connor said, Mr. Orr, please convey my heartfelt appreciation to Mr. Haneda for his very great generosity. I hardly know what to say. But I will have to call you back about this.
That's fine. You just let us know where to send it.
I'll call you back, Connor said.
He pushed the button to end the call and stared forward, frowning. There was a long silence. I said,
How much is a membership at that club worth?
$750, maybe $1 million.
I said,
Pretty nice gift from your friends.
I was thinking again of Graham and the way Graham had always implied that Connor was in the pocket of the Japanese. There didn't seem to be much doubt of it now. Connor was shaking his head.
I don't get it.
What's not to get? I said.
Jesus, Captain, seems pretty straightforward to me.
No, I don't get it, Connor said.
And then the phone rang again. This time, it was for me.
Lieutenant Smith, it's Louise Gerber. I'm so glad I was able to reach you.
I didn't recognize her name. I said, yes.
Since tomorrow is Saturday, I was wondering if you had any time to look at a house.
Then I remembered who she was. A month earlier, I had gone out with a broker to look at houses. Michelle is getting older, and I wanted to get her out of an apartment. To get her a backyard, if I could. It was pretty discouraging. Even with a real estate slump, the smallest houses were 400,000 and 500,000. I couldn't possibly qualify for that on my salary.
This is a very special situation, she said, and I thought of you and your little girl. It's a small house in Palms. Very small, but it's a corner lot, and it has a charming backyard. Flowers and a lovely lawn. The asking is 300. But the reason I thought of you is that the seller is willing to take back all the paper on it. I think you could get it for very little down. Do you want to see it?
I said, who is the seller?
I don't really know. It's a special situation. The house is owned by an elderly woman who has gone into a nursing home, and her son, who lives in Topeka, intends to sell it, but he wants an income flow instead of an outright sale. The property's not formally listed yet, but I know the seller is motivated. If you could get in tomorrow, you might be able to do something. And the backyard is charming. I can just see your little girl there. Now Connor was looking at me. I said, Miss Gerber, I'd have to know more about it, who the seller is, and so on. She sounded surprised. Gee, I thought you'd jump at it. A situation like this doesn't come along very often. Don't you want to look at it? Connor was looking at me, nodding. He mouthed, say yes. I'll have to get back to you about this, I said. All right, Lieutenant, she said. She sounded reluctant. Please let me know.
I will.
I hung up.
What the hell is going on?
I said, because there wasn't any way to get around it. Between us, we had just been offered a lot of money. A lot of money. Connor shook his head.
I don't know.
Is it to do with Microcon?
I don't know. I thought Microcon was a small company. This doesn't make sense.
He looked very uneasy.
What exactly is Microcon?
I said, I think I know who to ask.
Microcon? Ron Levine said, lighting a big cigar. Sure, I can tell you about Microcon. It's an ugly story. We were sitting in the newsroom of American Financial Network, a cable news operation located near the airport. Through the window of Ron's office, I could see the white satellite dishes on the roof of the adjacent garage. Ron puffed on his cigar and grinned at us. He had been a financial reporter at the Times before taking an on-camera job here. AFN was one of the few television operations where the on-camera people weren't scripted. They had to know what they were talking about, and Ron did. Microcon, he said, was formed 5 years ago by a consortium of American computer manufacturers. The company was intended to develop the next generation of X-ray lithography machines for computer chips. At the time Microcon started up, there were no American manufacturers of lithography machines. They'd all been put out of business in the 80s, under intense competition from the Japanese. Microcon developed new technology and has been building machines for American companies. Okay?
Okay, I said.
2 years ago, Microcon was sold to Darley Higgins, a management company in Georgia. Darley's other operations were foundering. The company decided to sell Microcon to raise cash. They found a buyer in Akai Ceramics, an Osaka company that already made lithography machines in Japan. Akai had plenty of cash and was willing to acquire the American company for a high price. Then Congress moved to stop the sale.
Why?
The decline of American business is starting to disturb even Congress. We've lost too many basic industries to Japan. Steel and shipbuilding in the 60s, television and computer chips in the 70s, machine tools in the 80s. One day somebody wakes up and realizes these industries are vital for American defense. We've lost the ability to make components essential to our national security.
We're entirely dependent on Japan to supply them. So Congress starts to worry. But I hear the sale is going through anyway.
Why? Do you guys have something to do with the sale?
In a sense, Connor said. Lucky you, Ron said, puffing on his cigar. If you're involved in a sale to the Japanese, it's like striking oil. Everybody gets rich. You two are looking at some pretty big gifts, I imagine.
Connor nodded. Very big.
I'm sure, Ron said. They'll take care of you. Buy you a house or a car, get you cheap financing, something like that.
I said, why would they do that?
Ron laughed.
Why would they eat sushi? It's the way they conduct business.
Connor said, but isn't Microcon a small sale?
Yeah, pretty small. The company's worth $100 million. Akai's buying it for $150 million. On top of that, they probably have another $20 million in incentives to the current corporate officers, maybe $10 million in legal, $10 million in consultant fees spread around Washington, and $10 million in miscellaneous gifts for people like you. So call it $200 million in total.
I said, $200 million for $100 million company? Why are they paying more than it's worth?
They're not, Ron said. As far as they're concerned, they're getting a bargain.
Why?
Because, Ron said, if you own the machines that are used to make something, like computer chips, you own the downstream industries that depend on those machines. Microcon will give them control over the American computer industry. And, as usual, we're allowing it to happen. Just the way we lost our television industry and our machine tool industry.
What happened to the TV industry? I said. He glanced at his watch.
After World War II, America was the world's leading manufacturer of televisions. 27 American companies like Zenith, RCA, GE, and Emerson had a solid technological lead over foreign manufacturers. American companies were successful around the world, except in Japan. They couldn't penetrate the closed Japanese market. They were told if they wanted to sell in Japan, they had to license their technology to Japanese companies. And they did, reluctantly, under pressure from the American government, which wanted to keep Japan as a friendly ally against Russia. Okay?
Okay.
Now, licensing is a bad idea. It means Japan gets our technology for their own use, and we lose Japan as an export market. Pretty soon, Japan begins to make cheap black-and-white TVs and exports them to America. Something we can't do in Japan, right?
By 1972, 60% of American black and white sales are imports. By 1976, 100% are imports. We've lost the black and white market. American workers don't make those sets anymore. Those jobs are gone from America. We say it doesn't matter. Our companies have moved on to color. But the Japanese government starts an intensive program to develop a color television industry. Once again, Japan licenses American technology, refines it in their protected markets, and floods us with exports. Once again, exports drive out American companies. Exactly the same story. By 1980, only three American companies still make color TVs. By 1987, there's only one, Zenith.
But Japanese sets were better and cheaper, I said.
They may have been better, Ron said. But they were only cheaper because they were sold below production cost to wipe out American competitors. That's called dumping. It's illegal under both American and international law.
Then why didn't we stop it?
Good question, especially since dumping was only one of many illegal Japanese marketing techniques. They also fixed prices. They had something called the 10th Day Group. Japanese managers met every 10 days in a Tokyo hotel to set prices in America. We protested, but the meetings continued. They also pushed distribution of their products by collusive arrangements. The Japanese allegedly paid millions in kickbacks to American distributors like Sears. They engaged in massive customs fraud, and they destroyed the American industry, which could not compete. Of course, our companies protested and sued for relief. There were dozens of cases of dumping, fraud, and antitrust brought against Japanese companies in federal court. Dumping cases are usually resolved within a year. But our government provided no help,
and the Japanese are skilled foot draggers. They paid American lobbyists millions to plead their case. By the time the suits came to trial 12 years later, the battle was over in the marketplace. And, of course, all during this time, American companies could never fight back in Japan. They couldn't even get a foot in the door in Japan. You're saying the Japanese took over the television industry illegally? Ron shrugged. They couldn't have done it without our help, he said. Our government was coddling Japan, which they saw as a tiny emerging country. And American industry was perceived as not needing government help. There's always been a strain of anti-business sentiment in America, but our government never seemed to realize it's just not the same here. When Sony develops the Walkman, we don't say, "Nice product. Now you have to license it to GE and sell it through an American company." If they seek distribution, we don't tell them, "I'm sorry, but American stores all have pre-existing arrangements with American suppliers. You'll have to distribute through an American company here." If they seek patents, we don't say, "Patents take 8 years to be awarded, during which time your application will be publicly available so that our companies can read what you've invented and copy it free of charge, so that by the time we issue a patent, our companies will already have their own version of your technology." We don't do any of those things. Japan does all of them. Their markets are closed. Our markets are wide open. It's not a level playing field. In fact, it's not a playing field at all. It's a one-way street. And by now, we have a defeatist business climate in this country. American companies got their asses handed to them in black and white television. They got their asses handed to them in color television. The U.S. government refused to help our companies fight illegal Japanese trade practices. So when Ampex invented the VCR, they didn't even try to make a commercial product. They just licensed the technology to Japan and moved on. And pretty soon you find that American companies don't do research. Why develop new technology if your own government is so hostile to your efforts that you won't be able to bring it to market? But isn't American business weak and badly managed? That's the standard line, Ron said, as promoted by the Japanese and their American spokesmen. It's only with a few episodes that people ever glimpsed how outrageous the Japanese really were. Like the Hudai case. You know that one? Hudai was a machine tool company that claimed its patents and licenses were being violated by companies in Japan. A federal judge sent Hudai's lawyer to Japan to gather evidence. But the Japanese refused to issue him a visa. You're kidding. What do they care? Ron said. They know we'll never retaliate. When the Hudai case came before the Reagan administration, it did nothing. So Hudai got out of machine tools, because nobody can compete against dumped products. That's the whole point of doing it. Don't you lose money if you dump? For a while, yes. But you're selling millions of units, so you can refine your production lines and get your costs down. A couple of years later, you really can make the products for a lower cost. Meanwhile, you've wiped out the competition, and you control the market. You see, the Japanese think strategically. They're in for the long haul, for how things will look 50 years from now. An American company has to show profit every 3 months, or the CEO and the officers will be out on the street. But the Japanese don't care about short-term profits at all. They want market share. Business is like warfare to them, gaining ground, wiping out the competition, getting control of a market. That's what they've been doing for the last 30 years. So the Japanese dumped steel, televisions, consumer electronics, computer chips, machine tools, and nobody stopped them. And we lost those industries. Japanese companies and the Japanese government target specific industries, which they take over. Industry after industry, year after year, while we sit around and spout off about free trade. But free trade is meaningless unless there is also fair trade. And the Japanese don't believe in fair trade at all. You know, there's a reason the Japanese love Reagan. They cleaned up during his presidency. In the name of free trade, he spread our legs real wide. Why don't Americans understand this? I said. Connor laughed. Why do they eat hamburgers? It's the way they are, Kohai.
From the newsroom, a woman called. Somebody named Connor here? Call for you from the Four Seasons Hotel.
Connor glanced at his watch and stood up. Excuse me. He walked out into the newsroom. Through the glass, I saw him talking on the phone, making notes.
You realize, Ron said, it's all still going on. Why is a Japanese camera cheaper in New York than in Tokyo? You ship it halfway around the world, pay import duty and distribution costs, and it's still cheaper? How is that possible? Japanese tourists buy their own products here because they're cheaper. Meanwhile, American products in Japan cost 70% more than here. Why doesn't the American government get tough? I don't know. Part of the answer is up there.
He pointed to the monitor in his office. A distinguished-looking man was talking above a running ticker tape. The sound was turned low.
You see that guy? That's David Rawlings, professor of business at Stanford, specialist in the Pacific Rim. He's a typical. Turn that up, will you?
He might be talking about Microcon.
I turned the knob on the set. I heard Rawlings say,
Think American attitudes are completely irrational. After all, Japanese companies are providing jobs for Americans, while American companies are moving jobs offshore, taking them away from their own people. The Japanese can't understand what the complaints are about.
Ron sighed. Typical bullshit, he said. On the screen, Professor Rawlings was saying,
I think the American people are rather ungrateful for the help our country is getting from foreign investors.
Ron laughed.
Rawlings is part of the group we call the Chrysanthemum Kissers, academic experts who deliver the Japanese propaganda line. They don't really have a choice, because they need access to Japan to work. And if they start to sound critical, their contacts in Japan dry up. Doors are closed to them. And in America, the Japanese will whisper in certain ears that the offending person is not to be trusted, or that their views are out of date, or worse, that they're racist. Anybody who criticizes Japan is a racist. Pretty soon, these academics begin to lose speaking engagements and consulting jobs. They know what's happened to their colleagues who step out of line, and they don't make the same mistake.
Connor came back into the room. He said, Is there anything illegal about this Microcon sale?
Sure, Ron said, depending on what Washington decides to do. Akai Ceramics already has 60% of the American market. Microcon will give it a virtual monopoly. If Akai were an American company, the government would block the sale on antitrust grounds. But since Akai is not an American company, the sale isn't scrutinized closely. In the end, it'll probably be allowed.
You mean a Japanese company can have a monopoly in America, but an American company can't?
That's the usual outcome these days, Ron said.
But American laws often promote the sale of our companies to foreigners. Like Matsushita buying Universal Studios.
Universal's been for sale for years. Several American companies tried to buy it, but couldn't. Westinghouse tried in 1980. No deal. Violates antitrust. RCA tried. No deal. Violates conflict of interest. But when Matsushita came in, there were no laws against it at all. Recently, our laws changed. Under present law, RCA could buy Universal. But back then, no. Microcon is just the latest example of crazy American regulations.
I said, But what do American computer companies say about the Microcon sale?
Ron said, American companies don't like the sale, but they don't oppose it either.
Why not?
Because American companies feel overregulated by the government already. 40% of all American exports are covered by security regulations. Our government doesn't allow our computer companies to sell to Eastern Europe. The Cold War is over, but the regulations still exist. Meanwhile, the Japanese and Germans are selling products like mad. So the Americans want less regulation, and they see any attempt to block the Microcon sale as government interference.
I said, It still doesn't make sense to me.
I agree, Ron said. The American companies are going to get killed in the next few years.
because if Japan is the sole source of chip-making machines, they're in a position to withhold the machines from American companies. Would they do that?
They've done it before, Ron said.
Ion implanters and other machines. But the American companies can't get together. They squabble among themselves. And meanwhile, the Japanese are buying high-tech companies at the rate of about one every 10 days. For the last 6 years, we're being disemboweled. But our government doesn't pay attention, because we have something called CFIUS, the Committee on Foreign Investment in the United States, that monitors the sale of high-tech companies. Except CFIUS never does anything. Of the last 500 sales, only one was blocked. Company after company gets sold, and nobody in Washington says boo. Finally, Senator Morton makes a stink and says, wait a minute here. But nobody's listening to him.
The sale is going through anyway.
That's what I heard today. The Japanese PR machine is hard at work, cranking out favorable publicity. And they are tenacious. They are on top of everything. I mean everything.
There was a knock at the door, and a blonde woman stuck her head in.
Sorry to disturb you, Ron, she said, but Keith just got a call from the Los Angeles representative for NHK, Japanese National Television. He wants to know why our reporter is bashing Japan.
Ron frowned. Bashing Japan? What's he talking about?
He claims our reporter said on air, the damn Japanese are taking over this country.
Come on, Ron said. Nobody would say that, on air. Who's supposed to have said that?
Lenny, in New York, over the back hall, the woman said.
Ron shifted in his chair. Uh-oh, he said. Did you check the tapes?
Yeah, she said. They're tracing the download now in the main control room. But I assume it's true.
Hell.
I said, what's the back hall?
Our satellite feed. We pick up segments from New York and Washington every day and replay them. There's always about a minute before and after that isn't aired. We cut it out, but the raw transmission can be picked up by anybody with a private dish who wants to hunt for our signal. And people do. We warn the talent to be careful what they do in front of a camera. But last year, Louise unbuttoned her blouse and mic'd herself. And we got calls from all over the country.
Ron's phone rang. He listened for a moment and said,
okay, I understand. And hung up. They checked the tape. Lenny was talking on camera before the feed, and he said to Louise, the goddamn Japanese are going to own this country if we don't wise up. It wasn't on air, but he did say it.
He shook his head ruefully.
The NHK guy knows we didn't run it?
Yeah, but he's saying it can be picked up, and he's protesting on that basis.
Hell, Ron said. So they even monitor our backhaul. Jesus, what does Keith want to do?
Keith says he's tired of warning New York talent. He wants you to handle it.
Does he want me to call the NHK guy?
He says use your judgment, but we have a deal with NHK for the half-hour show we send them every day, and he doesn't want that risked. He thinks you should apologize.
Ron sighed. Now I have to apologize for what wasn't even on air. God damn it.
He looked at us. Guys, I have to go. Was there anything else?
No,
I said. Good luck.
Listen, Ron said, we all need good luck. You know NHK is starting Global News Network with $1 billion in capitalization. They're going to take on Ted Turner's CNN around the world. And if past history is any guide...
He shrugged.
Kiss the American media goodbye.
As we were leaving, I heard Ron say on the phone,
Mr. Kasaka?
Ron Levine, over here at AFN.
Yes, sir.
Yes, Mr. Kasaka.
Sir, I wanted to express my concern and deep apologies about what our reporter said over the satellite.
We closed the door and left.
Where now? I said.
The Four Seasons Hotel is favored by stars and politicians, and it has a graceful entrance, but we parked around the corner by the service entrance. A large dairy truck was pulled up to a loading dock, and kitchen staff was unloading cartons of milk. We had been waiting here for 5 minutes. Connor glanced at his watch.
I said, why are we here? We're complying with the Supreme Court, Kohai. At the loading dock, a woman in a business suit came out, looked around, and waved. Connor waved back. She disappeared again. Connor got out his billfold and took out a couple of 20s. One of the first things I learned as a detective, Connor said, is that hotel staff can be extremely helpful, particularly since the police have so many restrictions these days. We can't go into a hotel room without a warrant. If we did, whatever we found in a search would be inadmissible, right? Right. But the maids can go in. Valet and housekeeping and room service can go in. Uh-huh. So I've learned to maintain contacts at all the big hotels. He opened the door. I'll only be a moment. He walked to the loading dock and waited. I tapped the steering wheel with my hands. The words came into my head. I changed my mind. This love is fine. Goodness gracious, great balls of fire. On the loading dock, a maid in uniform came out and talked to Connor briefly. He took notes. She held something golden in the palm of her hand. He didn't touch it. He just looked at it and nodded. She slipped it back in her pocket. Then he gave her money. She went away. You shake my nerves and you rattle my brain. Too much love drives a man insane. You broke my will, but what a thrill. A valet came out onto the loading dock, carrying a man's blue suit on a hanger. Connor asked a question, and the valet looked at his watch before he answered. Then Connor crouched down and peered closely at the lower edges of the suit coat. He opened the jacket and examined the trousers on the hanger. The valet took away the first suit and brought a second one out onto the dock. This one was a blue pinstripe suit. Connor repeated his inspection. He seemed to find something on the coat and scraped it carefully into a small glassine bag. Then he paid the valet and walked back to the car. I said, checking Senator Rowe? Checking a number of things, he said. But yes, Senator Rowe. Rowe's aide had white panties in his pocket last night, but Cheryl was wearing black panties. That's true, Connor said, but I think we are making progress. What have you got in the bag? He took the little glassine bag out and held it to the light. I saw small dark strands through the plastic. Carpet fibers, I think. Dark, like the carpet at the Nakamoto conference room. Have to check with the lab to be sure. Meanwhile, we have another problem to solve. Start the car. Where are we going? Darley Higgins, the company that owns Microcon. In the lobby beside the receptionist, a workman was mounting large gold letters on the wall. Darley Higgins, Incorporated. Beneath that, it read, Excellence in Management. More workmen were laying carpet in the hallway. We showed our badges and asked to see the head of Darley Higgins, Arthur Griman. The receptionist had a southern accent and an upturned nose.
Mr. Griman is in meetings all day. Is he expecting you?
We're here about the Microcon sale.
Then you want Mr. Enders, our vice president for publicity. He speaks to people about Microcon.
All right, Connor said. We sat down on a couch in the reception area. On a couch across the room sat a pretty woman in a tight skirt. She had a roll of blueprints under her arm. The workmen continued to hammer. I said,
I thought the company was in financial trouble. Why are they redecorating?
Connor shrugged. The secretary answered the phone, routing the calls.
Darley Higgins, one moment, please. Darley Higgins. Oh, please hold, Senator. Darley Higgins. Yes, thank you.
I picked up a brochure from the coffee table. It was the annual report of Darley Higgins Management Group, with offices in Atlanta, Dallas, Seattle, San Francisco, and Los Angeles. I found a picture of Arthur Griman. He looked happy and self-satisfied. The report included an essay signed by him entitled, A Commitment to Excellence. The secretary said to us,
Mr. Enders will be right with you.
Thank you, Connor said. A moment later, two men in business suits walked out into the hallway. The woman with the blueprint stood. She said,
Hello, Mr. Griman.
Hello, Beverly, the older man said. I'll be with you in a minute. Connor stood up, too. The secretary immediately said, Mr. Griman, these men... Just a minute, Griman said. He turned to the man with him, who was younger, in his early 30s. Just make sure you get it straight with Roger, Griman said. The younger man was shaking his head. He won't like it. I know he won't, but tell him anyway. $6.4 million in direct compensation for the CEO is the minimum. But Arthur, just tell him. I will, Arthur, the younger man said, smoothing his tie. He lowered his voice. But the board may balk at raising you above six when company earnings are down so much. We're not talking about earnings, Griman said. We're talking about compensation. It has nothing to do with earnings. The board has to match current compensation levels for chief executives. If Roger can't bring the board into line on this, I'm going to cancel the March meeting and ask for changes. You tell him that. Okay, I will, Arthur, but... Just do it. Call me tonight. Right, Arthur. They shook hands. The younger man walked off unhappily. The receptionist said, Mr. Griman, these gentlemen... Griman turned to us. Connor said, Mr. Griman, we'd like to speak to you for a minute about Microcon. And he turned slightly aside and showed his badge. Griman exploded in rage. Oh, for Christ's sake, not again. This is goddamned harassment. Harassment? What would you call it? I've had senatorial staffers here. I've had the FBI here. Now I have the L.A. police. We're not criminals. We own a company and we have the right to sell it. Where is Lewis? The receptionist said, Mr. Anders is coming. Connor said calmly, Mr. Griman, I'm sorry to disturb you. We have only one question. It'll just take a minute. Griman glowered. What's your question? How many bidders were there for Microcon? That's none of your business, he said. Anyway, our agreement with Akai stipulates that we can't discuss the sale publicly in any way. Connor said, Was there more than one bidder? Look, you have questions, you talk to Anders. I'm busy. He turned to the woman with blueprints. Beverly, what have you got for me? I have a revised layout for the boardroom, Mr. Griman, and tile samples for the washroom. A very nice gray I think you'll like. Good, good. He led her down the hallway away from us. Connor watched them go, and then abruptly turned toward the elevator. Come on, Kohai. Let's get some fresh air. What does it matter if there were other bidders, I said, when we were back in the car. It goes back to the original question we had, Connor said. Who wants to embarrass Nakamoto? We know the sale of Microcon has strategic significance. That's why Congress is upset. But that almost certainly means other parties are upset, too. In Japan? Exactly. Who will know that? Akai. The Japanese receptionist tittered as she saw Connor's badge. Connor said, We would like to see Mr. Yoshida. Yoshida was the head of the company. One moment, please. She got up and hurried away, almost running. Akai Ceramics was located on the fifth floor of a bland office block in El Segundo. The decor was spare and industrial-looking. From the reception area, we could see into a large space which was not partitioned. Lots of metal desks and people at the phones. The soft click of word processors. I looked at the office. Pretty bare. All business, Connor said, nodding. In Japan, ostentation is frowned on. It means you are not serious. When old Mr. Matsushita was the head of the third biggest company in Japan, he still took the regular commercial jet between his head offices in Osaka and Tokyo. He was the head of a $50 billion company, but no private jets for him. As we waited, I looked at the people working at the desks. A handful were Japanese. Most were Caucasian. Everyone wore blue suits. There were almost no women. In Japan, Connor said,
If a company is doing poorly, the first thing that happens is the executives cut their own salaries. They feel responsible for the success of the company, and they expect their own fortunes to rise and fall as the company succeeds or fails. The woman came back and sat at her desk without speaking. Almost immediately, a Japanese man wearing a blue suit came toward us. He had gray hair, horn-rimmed glasses, and a solemn manner. He said, "Good morning. I am Mr. Yoshida." Connor made the introductions. We all bowed and exchanged business cards. Mr. Yoshida took each card with both hands, bowing each time formally. We did the same. I noticed that Connor did not speak Japanese to him. Yoshida led us to his office. It had windows looking toward the airport. The furnishings were austere. "Would you like coffee or tea?" "No, thank you," Connor said. "We are here in an official capacity."
"I understand."
He gestured for us to sit down. "We would like to talk to you about the purchase of Microcon."
"Ah, yes. A troubling matter. But I am not aware that it should involve the police."
"Perhaps it doesn't," Connor said. "Can you tell us about the sale, or is the agreement sealed?" Mr. Yoshida looked surprised.
"Sealed? Not at all. It is all very open, and has been from the beginning. We were approached by Mr. Kobayashi, representing Darley Higgins in Tokyo, in September of last year. That was the first we learned the company was for sale. Frankly, we were surprised that it would be offered. We began negotiations in early October. The negotiating teams had the basis of a rough agreement by mid-November. We proceeded to the final stage of negotiations, but then the Congress raised objections on November 16th.
Connor said, "You said you were surprised that the company would be offered for sale."
"Yes, certainly."
"Why is that?"
Mr. Yoshida spread his hands on his desk and spoke slowly. "We understood that Microcon was a government-owned company. It had been financed in part by funds from the American government. 13% of capitalization, if I remember. In Japan, that would make it a government-owned company. So naturally, we were cautious to enter into negotiations. We do not want to offend. But we received assurance from our representatives in Washington there would be no objection to the purchase."
"I see.
But now there are difficulties, as we feared. I think now we make a cause for Americans. In Washington, some people are upset. We do not wish this."
"You didn't expect Washington would make objections?"
Mr. Yoshida gave a diffident shrug. "The two countries are different. In Japan, we know what to expect. Here, there is always an individual who may have another opinion and speak it. But Akai Ceramics does not wish a high profile. It is awkward now."
Connor nodded sympathetically. "It sounds as if you want to withdraw."
"Many in the Home Office criticize me for not knowing what would happen. But I tell them it is impossible to know. Washington has no firm policy. It changes every day, according to the politics."
He smiled and added,
"Or I would say that is how it seems to us."
"But you expect the sale to go forward?"
"This I cannot say. Perhaps the criticism from Washington will be too much. And you know the Tokyo government wants to be friends with America. They give pressure on business not to make purchases that will upset America. Rockefeller Center and Universal Studios, these purchases that make criticism for us. We are told to be Yojinbukai. It means discreet," Connor said.
End of side 5. To continue, turn the cassette over.